Do you know how to be CEO? Success comes from combining two perspectives, the nature of the job and your nature as an individual.
This is the Economics for Business podcast. We are here to help all businesses become champions for customers and value, improving lives with preferred and innovative products and services. We offer you the knowledge and tools to make your entrepreneurial journey a successful one. Now, here's your host, Hunter Hastings.
Hi, Hunter Hastings here. There are lots of subjects to be studied, investigated, developed, and mastered. Our guest today has chosen CEOs as his study area, both the CEO job and the individual as CEO. As a job, the concept of the CEO position can seem overwhelming. It doesn't matter whether your title is chief executive officer or executive chairman or president or executive vice president or general partner or division head or team leader. Your job is at the top of a hierarchy or the center of a network, and all paths lead to your door. All questions are your questions. All resource allocation issues are yours to resolve. How can one person possibly take all that responsibility or complete all those tasks? It seems too much. Our guest today is Bart Jackson, CEO of Prometheus Publishing. So he knows whereof he speaks. He is a CEO. He's also surveyed thousands of CEOs worldwide and interviewed and collaborated with hundreds more in his quest to understand. He's distilled all his knowledge into two books. The first is The Art of the CEO, a guide to the job itself, from the job description to the components such as crafting a vision and developing a leadership style, to choosing executives and a board, and then all summed up in a gripping lessons learned section. The second book is CEO of Yourself, which is about the person, that's you, in the CEO position. This collection includes your choices, your attitude, your principles, your ambition, your career, your cultivation of others, and of yourself. The combination of the two perspectives is compelling: the job and how to do it, the position and the person. Bart has traveled the globe, from Tibet to Tasmania to Tierra del Fuego, as he puts it, to interview the most successful and fascinating CEOs in order to create his unique knowledge space. He's a well-known international speaker and author of literally thousands of articles for scores of business journals worldwide. Bart, welcome to the Economics for Business podcast.
Oh, well, and I am very glad to be here. Actually, it is wonderful because it's so nice to be with someone who has both the managerial aspect of economics and the theory, as well as the ability to put it into practice. So, Hunter, I'm really happy to be with you.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And that's exactly what we try to do is identify some useful theory and then put it into practice. So you're an expert, Bart, on being CEO.
Yeah.
You are one. You've interviewed hundreds of them. You've gathered dozens of them as mentors and experts and sources. You've studied CEOs. You've studied the job the CEOs do, and you've studied the individuals who occupy the role. So we're going to try to download some of the immense wisdom you've gathered over the years in that activity. And I'm going to just give some context, which comes directly from one of your books, Bart, which we'll refer to as we go along. In The Art of the CEO, you define an audience, which is terrific. That's what we always advise people to do, know your audience. And you say it's individuals in a position of directing a private for-profit or a nonprofit organization with, you take a number, $3 million or more in revenue, which means it's of significant size, 50 plus employees. It's got other executives, so the CEO isn't acting on their own. They've got a board. But the title could be CEO, president, executive officer, managing director, founder, owner, all of those things. And you've also interviewed a lot of CEOs in S&P 500 and Fortune 500 and so on. So your data is vast. Let's start with how you got into this, your history of interviewing and analyzing CEOs. Where did it all begin?
I have had just one of the most rare and privileged careers that I've spent my life wandering the globe, and I always say carting my pen in curiosity, but it's really, my goal has been to find the most fascinating and interesting people and hold them to light. And I did this as a journalist from my earliest days, and I worked for several magazines, and then I went off on my own. Mainly I could meet more people and make more money freelancing, and I did. And then I did it as an author, as a book author. And then for the last dozen years, I've done this as head of Prometheus Publishing and also hosting my own The Art of the CEO radio show. But there was something. I came from a family that was very outdoors oriented. This was back in the days when backpacking was called camping. And I became fascinated by the people who had done these amazing deeds. Piotr Raczewski, who was the only man to paddle the Amazon from source to mouth. Verlin Kruger, who took his canoe around the Western Hemisphere, North and South America, the Americans on Everest. And I found out all this time I was writing about them and traveling with them, I found out I had these publishers who kept pulling me back into the world of business. And I found out something. The only people in the world who are as exciting as explorers are entrepreneurs. They're both sort of half doer, half dreamer, held together by the duct tape of stress. And it's wonderful. So I meet this guy, Piotr, who's down in the Kolka Canyon. We're going down the world's steepest canyon. We have this TV guy who's carrying his camera. The camera breaks. Piotr takes it into the tent. He's an explorer. Things need to be fixed right then. He's never seen one. He takes it all apart and he fixes it together. This is the kind of person that you meet as an explorer. Meanwhile, but back in the business field, I meet Joe Ciola, who decided he was searching for a board game, Watch Your Mouth, and it wasn't there, so he made it. And he sold over 100,000 units before he even had a product, which he then hustled to get up. In other words, these are fascinating people. How do they do it? Why do they do it? And that's what I've been doing my whole life.
Well, that's fantastic. It's also a deep insight. I love the parallel between explorers and entrepreneurs. That's a good one to explore. So let's start with the job, Bart.
Yeah.
And you have an interesting little algorithm at the beginning of the book, which is if you add up the percentages of time that CEOs have to devote to various activities, it comes to way over 100.
Yes. And
you call that juggling complexity. So what have you found out about juggling complexity, and how do you advise people to juggle with complexity?
Well, the truth is, being a CEO is, I always say, it's not so much of a learning curve, but more akin to stepping off of a ledge and being expected to fly. And that's really what it is. That's why even when I started the book, The Art of the CEO, I talked about how to raise one. So it's a little parental guide. But the thing is, when we did The Art of the CEO, we surveyed over 2,000 CEOs all around the world. And their number one thing, as you have just pointed out, Hunter, is the complexity of the job, the number of items on the plate, each one of which may be a deal breaker. And the way I have seen people handle this, I've seen it handled best is, first of all, a friend of mine, Bill Crowd, he's one of the top CEO counselors around. He keeps saying that real CEOs have hobbies. They make time for it. They structure a workday based on their capabilities, not based on their technology or the screams of others. And that gives them a framework for their job. And the second thing is that then with the complexity, with all these items on your plate, you have to sort of separate the most important from the most immediate. And that's a very big challenge. And the way to do it, I've always felt, is to, number one, find the value proposition of your firm and what you're doing. In other words, if I make Ford 150 trucks, why is it that for some reason, the people who drive them see this as united with their Christian ethic. I mean, you really want to know what you are giving people. And with those priorities, that will sort out your priorities. You say, here's what I'm giving. Here's what I want to be giving. And believe me, believe it or not, that actually sorts out how you get what projects need to be handled, because you know what's most important that way. And the other thing is, I was just quickly, you need to make decisions. You need to develop what I call a ready response advice team. Go through all the people in the factory, people who can, that you train, and you set them on edge to give you the advice you need on a decision immediately, or get that input quickly, get in and get out with it. So that's the second thing.
So you say one way to deal with complexity is knowing where you're going, which is vision and strategy and those kinds of business school buzzwords. Is that the same as having your value proposition implanted in your brain so that you always know which direction to go in? Do you equate those?
No, you're right. The vision, and very sharp of you, Hunter, is that, yes, you need the vision is something that you have, is that guiding light that you always have before you. It is your purpose. And I sort of pull the vision, the CEO's vision, is it's what do you want you and your firm to be? What do you want to be doing? And what do you want to be providing? And if you put those all together, basically, you come up with an idea that answers the question, why in God's name am I trudging into this office every day? What am I doing here, this madhouse? And now this is versus landmarks. Landmarks are sort of goals that you want to, a goal is a landmark that you want to hit on the way. And there's one British coal company which puts as its mission, we want to be the kind of company that produces 20 million tons of coal per annum, which is very lofty, I suppose, in its own way. But the deal is, I think the vision has to be a little more than that.
Right.
With apologies to the poet William Blake, there's two parts to a vision, as I see it. There is the what I call the vision of innocence and the vision of experience. And the vision of innocence comes first. And by that, I mean, what is Hunter Hastings taking over this company? What is Hunter going to do? What is your individual stamp that you're going to put on this firm? And your unique imagination launches as so you make our pharmaceutical company may be the resource tools for curing cancer, for those who cure cancer or whatever. In my own case, in my own firm, I looked at Bart's books and I looked at Prometheus Publishing, and I said, we want to provide the tools to help people to nudge business toward being a force for good. So there was something of my own personal belief in what I wanted in that, as well as what we were going to do, what we're going to be providing, and so forth. And after that comes what I call the vision of experience. And that's what the people themselves and their firm have, where they want to go, where the company, you're walking around the warehouse. Just as you've walked around the warehouse to find your own vision, you now walk around who can do what. What do the markets really want? And you adjust accordingly. And the technique in this is these two things are not separate. They are together. It's a way of the vision of experience open doors rather than collides with that. And the other technique, just one more, and that is that I think you as a CEO, you have to set aside time to think. And JFK, President John Kennedy did this. He would write in, he would make appointments in his notebook, not to review the marketing plan. You've already reviewed the marketing plan. The appointment is to think, once you have gotten all those facts in, to sit down and think about that marketing and what you want to do. Those separate times I have found to be, that's a great little technique.
Think on your own or think with others?
At this point, you want to think on your own. When you review the marketing plan, you call up your ready response team, you get them in. But then there's a time where just Hunter is sitting there and using that, in your case, that fabulous imagination you've got.
Well, that's That's great advice. And part of that discussion that you've just had and part of that advice is this brilliant way that you have of balancing big corporate things like vision and then what you call personal style.
No.
So it made me think that when you're walking around that metaphorical warehouse you just described, you're walking around with personal style. And that's a tool, you said. In the right hands, in the right situations, it becomes a leadership tool. So tell us about leadership style and what it depends on and how it's effective.
Well, there's two parts to being CEO. One is that you're prime minister, and the other is your king, your manager, your leader. So, and a good leader can inspire his troops to scrabble up over a wall with their bare hands. And the good manager, as prime minister, makes sure that there's enough ladders in the row so everyone can climb up over the wall at once. And you need both, of course. But your leadership style is what's going to attract you, is going to set you up as a hub and a linchpin and as the center, but also as the encourager, as the inspiration. If you have the right leadership style, it will make up for all those other inabilities and lacks you have. No one has everything. And so, I mean, my two great examples of this are George Washington and British General Bernard Montgomery Monty. They were both terrible tacticians. They were really bad at it, but they brought this resolute force of themselves. George Washington said when they were crossing the Delaware and everyone wants to go home, he said, "If I have to be the only man marching in there into Trenton, I will indeed go there and face the enemy myself alone." And Montgomery, I talked to a man who fought under Montgomery in Africa. He said everything was a muddle. Montgomery arrived. He had no better plans for tactics, but he said, "We draw a line in the sand. At this point, we fight. At this point, we die." And it all took hold. There was that resolution. And I would say the easiest way to develop a leadership style that I've ever seen, and I've seen this in all of them, is you fall in love and you become absorbed with your firm's mission, the project, the task, the thing at hand. And that becomes the lens through which every effort gets translated. They see this and the praise flows naturally because if I'm so focused on this and Hunter gives me a hand, I will naturally, "Oh God, thank you, Hunter. Wow, I really appreciate that." And on we go. And you feel encouraged. You feel like you've done something and so forth. It's, my wife's husband keeps saying, "There's nothing uglier in business than naked ambition. Best to cloak it in a love of good work." And I said, so don't, you have your personal needs, but they're not what you need to be showing. So, and you're always playing to that team.
Yeah.
A quick note. Did you know that we provide supplemental materials for each podcast? Listening to and understanding the key takeaways from our expert guests helps you think better about building a more beautiful business. Taking direct action and implementing these strategies is when the real work begins. Take a concrete, immediate step to implementing a better business model today by downloading the show notes and business tool we've created for this episode. Visit Mises.org/E4BPod. That's Mises.org/E4BPod. And click on today's episode. Now, back to our interview.
So does a CEO vary style with different missions? If I run one company and then I go run another company, am I going to change my style if the mission is different?
There's a core of you that will not and should not change. There are different styles of leadership in that, for instance, sometimes there's the unilateral decision maker versus the consensus builder. And I think that can shift within the need. Sometimes if you have just a multitude of disparate entities that you really have to bring together, you really need that consensus, whereas there are other times where you can make the unilateral decision and set up your persona and so forth. So yeah, I would say there is. It's many ways to communicate a vision.
And then you've touched on this already, I think, but let's drill down on it. You've got to communicate the vision. And get the buy-in from everybody who needs to join you in pursuing that vision. And is there any pattern for success there, Bart? You've seen a lot of people doing that kind of communication. And millions of words of consulting advice have been given on communication. What do you discern as the key to it?
Well, I will say the one thing I have seen about every single successful person and that I've ever known is that they have absolutely nothing whatsoever in common. And which leaves room for you. You know, that's the way I see it. But there's lots of ways you can get my favorite way came from a fellow named Joe Rigby, who was head of Pepco Holdings, a huge energy firm. And he had his vision of innocence. He developed it, put his stamp on it, and then with whiteboard and lots of miles on airplanes, he visited all, I think it was 40,000 employees, set them up in small groups, brought his whiteboard out and says, here's what it is. Let me add. Now, what do you want to add to this? What do you see as the vision and so forth? That is very admirable. And I think it's very wise in some situations. If you can do it, and if you're a guy like Joe and you have a logistics and so forth, you may not, that's not for everybody, but that something like that is a trend for communicating is it makes the vision a two-way thing. It's not a dictum hurled from Mount Olympus down at you who just sort of receive it. There is the feeling that I'm asking you for, you want to do it. And I mean, there is another way. I mean, you can hold many people have held what they call vision meetings. Denise Morrison, head of Campbell Soup, previous head of Campbell Soup, said, marvelous woman, she said, we are going to grow into the company that meets all the needs of the food buying consumer. There's a total change from just the can of soup and Andy Warhol. And so she got them together. And the trick to all of this is when you pull people together, you bring in, you talk about, you give that initial vision, then you bring in the names, you bring in all the people who will be involved, and you use lots of names, you use lots of departments. This is very inclusive. You talk about the strengths we have. All this time you're naming and involving people, reaching and pulling them in all the time. And then the third thing, and once you've got that, you've got the people, and then the third step is to add your innovations. A fellow named Chris Blees, accountant, a brilliant accountant, said, we're going to turn this Biggs Cofer accounting firm, of which he was CEO, he says, we are going to add on an investment banking arm. Here's why, here's how, and who's going to be involved. So, I mean, that would be sort of the third step. With the innovation first.
So you used a term there, but two-way communication. But in fact, I picked up from something that you wrote in the book that you said idea flow comes back through the organization, but you called it four-dimensional idea flow, which sounds like very advanced physics. How do you get four-way idea flow, and how do you encourage it?
Quantumly speaking, it involves... Cecil Rhodes said they can't all be gems. Anyway, the whole idea is that you have an idea. There are ideas that are coming from all over your organization, and the way I've seen it is to use all the dimensions to get them. Number one, you want to have both ways. You want to have it vertically, so that an idea comes from anywhere along the line, and it goes up the flagpole, up the ladder to the decision makers. That's not necessarily the leaders. So often there's about five people who can say no to a project in a corporation, and only one who can say yes, or two or three. Anyway, so you want to travel it up to the headlights of the decision makers, and back down for more input. So that's the vertical. Horizontally, you want to move out to all the other. Everyone, every department affected, involved in it. A fellow named Ken Parker, move from cutting the lawns to becoming the CEO of Atlantic City Electric in 18 years, he would literally, when every task, he would go out and go to each department affected, and he would say, well, what can I, when I'm going to do this, how can I make it easier? You reach out to every department. So that's sort of a horizontal thing. The third dimension is to reach outside your corporate box, and that is you solicit the advice of vendors, of the shipping, of the trucking firm, clients, of course, everyone outside whom your company touches. And believe me, you are going to win all kinds of points by soliciting their advice on a problem. And that's going to come back to praise you all the time. And the fourth dimension is, and as you say, good physics, is that of time. Ideas are most active in their infancy. You've got to catch them quick. They're also the most strongly defended in their infancy. The people who come up with them are going to be most enthusiastic and most willing to carry it through. So you have to develop a system that hears these ideas and brings them, sifts through them and brings them to light quickly. And that is really the fourth dimension.
Mm-hmm. Is part of that time management also maintaining that vigor and that energy for the idea over time? Because it sounds like the implication of what you said is it can fade away.
Well, that is true. And it has to, there is points where you have to put it, you have to quickly get it into action or mm-hmm. not. And that's part of the problem is that every idea you're either going to adopt, take a piece of, or put it under advisement for a later day. And if you're going to, you have to have your idea action team ready. And if you want to have an innovation department, which I love that, we have a creative department, which means everybody else doesn't have to think. If you want to have a creation department, they should be the ones who are most ready to take an idea and implement it. That's the job of a good creative department, not the ones who, you know, we are the elite who think and brainstorm. So.
Yeah, got it. So another segue that comes out of your book from what you were just saying is we're talking about ideas, but you said that the entrepreneurial process is a knowledge process, which we concur with 100%. And you have a great phrase, business presses knowledge into action to fulfill human needs. So you make that connection between knowledge and action. So what have you observed in practice, pressing knowledge into action? You said it's not a systematized step-by-step process. So how does it work?
Cogito ergo facit. I think therefore I make it or I create it. Anyway, that's really what business does. It's taking knowledge so the CEO himself has to be an incessant questioner and interviewer. One of the old models. I don't know if you've ever seen the television show Star Trek: The Next Generation. There was a character on there who was Captain Picard, and on a couple of times he was held up as the ideal leader, the ideal commander, and I took a count one time of the number of times he asked for support or questioned each one of his crew versus the number of orders he gave. And in this show, which did it very well, the number of questions he asked always came out larger than the number of orders. Mm-hmm. That's part of it. As my wife's husband keeps saying, the rich get richer, but the informed buy them out. And yes, you have to, But the whole idea of business is to take that knowledge and press it into action. There was a fellow who didn't say, gee, what fun it would be to launch a business, an online bookstore. He was working in a tech firm, and he saw that internet use had gone up 2,300% each year for the last 3 years. And he says, so Jeff Bezos says, you know, this may be the time to start Amazon, pressing mm-hmm. knowledge into action.
Yeah. The challenge, though, it seems to me, is that knowledge is flowing at a great rate. There's so much knowledge. It's really hard to absorb all of that and press it into action. So is there a selectivity in there? Is there some kind of organization of that massive flow of knowledge? It seems overwhelming in this day and age.
There's a massive flow of knowledge. I always say that technology has reduced the noble human pursuit of wisdom into the amassing of data. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to, if you can sort of make in your head this sort of a model of what's data, which is nothing more than the plural of anecdote, and what is then a fact, which can help you determine facts, which can help you then gather, turn it into wisdom, which is that amalgamation of lore that helps us survive. And I think that we all have to, the way I've seen that is the way I've seen the people who do this best, and I don't do it very well at all, but the people I've seen who do it best are able to, they come in with what they're looking for before they read or look or view. They have some ideas of what they're looking for. They're flexible, of course, but I mean, they know what would be I need wisdom. I need to know if I'm going to do a reverse merger or an IPO. With a reverse merger or if I'm going to go alone. And so they know certain things they're looking for when they go on. That's really the ones who seem to do it best.
Yeah. Interesting. That would be a scientific method, right? You've got a hypothesis. Now let's see if you can prove it or disprove it.
Exactly.
Another term that comes up a lot in business, and you mentioned it, is culture. Mm-hmm. And you have a provocative phrase, a CEO can never control a company's culture, but is the one who is credited or blamed for it. So have you learned about culture over the years?
I've got to be fair. I'm not fond of talking about the buzzword culture. I mean, California, their idea of culture is yogurt, but they have both Silicon Valley and Silicon Valley, where cleavage meets cleavage, and and they seem to be doing all right. So I mean, culture is, as far as I can see it, is the way people feel about work, and it is the way they behave at work when they think no one else is looking, and. That is, and the truth is, no one behaves the way you think they should. And I know I'm married; I get that advice all the time. And so this is why they can't really control it, because people are free will. You can nudge the company's culture as a CEO with your own attitude. But people are going to respond in their own way. I mean, you can create, what I'm saying, I guess you can create an atmosphere. That's really it. You, mm-hmm. You may be open and friendly, and you may respect all the people at hand. And that gives you a feeling. You may be open to questions and communications. You may express urgency in your work without frenzy. And the other thing is, and rather than respect, I know Paul Marciano is a great consultant, makes tons of money telling people to respect their workers. And I say, that's not nearly enough. I say, you have to show a concern for workers. There's a difference. You can respect me and I can feel respected, and that's very nice. But if you show a concern for me, you've got me. I'll put my shoulder to your wheel anytime.
Yeah.
That's the atmosphere that you can create. But can you guarantee a culture from that? No. And you don't make, you're not a sculptor, you're not a culture sculptor.
So the one thing that you can be in direct control of is building your own team. Mm. And choice and hiring are super important variables there. And that seems a difficult one to become good at. We had Jackie Boland, a CEO, on the show a couple mm-hmm. of weeks ago, number 113. And she said, boy, it took forever to become good at hiring. She thought she did get to be good at the end. And as you grow, you're trying to hire new people. It's not the same kinds of people you were hiring 2 years ago or 5 years ago. So what have you found out about team building and hiring the right people?
God, hiring is like, it's like a marriage. It's based on the key to it all is the pure unmitigated luck of stumbling across the right people to begin with. I'm into that. It is true, but it goes for the C-suite. There is one thing though, and I think that you just put me in mind of something. You said, Jackie was saying, you do become good at hiring. You have to train yourself. I, for instance, I'm a romantic, and by that I mean I find the ideal, I find the best. And so as a result, I think everyone, I have a tendency to think everyone is wonderful, and which means that I have a blind side. So you sort of have to find the kind of people that you're attracted to and just sort of factor that in to your hiring. The ones I've seen that seem to be able to attract the best people, they don't look for an advisor. They don't who is a one slot person. In other words, they don't go to get just the top talent, or they don't go to get someone who's really good at building consensus. They look for a person. They look for character. They look for someone who works with it and has the one thing who has what I call an intellectual curiosity about the firm, about what he's doing. And those are the two things I've seen. And I will say the only other thing I've seen is nowadays there's a great urge to do something much, much better than we've done before. And that is the whole idea of diversity. We don't need more women on the boardroom. What we need is we need better people in the boardroom, and we need to be casting our net over so that we can get that Ethiopian woman who has that remarkable marketing prowess. Mm. That's okay. And so I will say we are casting our net wider. And the great thing about business is it's become very egalitarian because so long as you can make profit for us, I frankly, Scarlett, I don't care.
No, exactly. It should be very egalitarian based on contribution and merit. We believe that. Switching gears a little bit, I looked at your book called CEO of Yourself, one of the many books you've written in this field, and that's a bit more individual focused. And you have this beautiful section on personal brand building, which sometimes the way it's portrayed in this age of Facebook and Instagram is a bit self-indulgent, but you say, no, it's about embracing the idea of the brand of me. And you talk about doing it in a very classical way, which is know your customer first for your brand and then build the brand that the customer wants. So can you tell us about the brand of me and how we tackle that?
Well, thank you for picking up on that. That was a very difficult thing to write. And the one thing that came down to me is the process of branding, and this is whether it's for your corporation or yourself, the process of branding is made in the production department and the service department, not in the PR and marketing departments. Mm-hmm. It's not how you want to appear. It's what you want to be. And if that's, so you go for that. So I say to myself, I would look around. I say, so what is Bart? What is the ideal Bart that I want to build? And so like any good business person, I walk around my warehouse and I see what I've got. I find my strengths and my interests. I listen to the pieces of praise that I have gotten through my whole life, and I pull out a common thread in that. People, are you the sort of person that everyone seems to turn to when they have problems? Are you the sort of person that when they want someone to make the presentation or to ask the right questions, they call on? So you find you can find that in a reflection from others. You can find those strengths and, of course, your own personal interests. And then, of course, and you can say, well, this is what I have to offer. And then there's the other thing, and that is you have to find your own principles. And I don't mean the principles of your faith or of your workplace or of your government, but the principles that you, Hunter, that I, Bart, hold dear and believe. And I literally say it's worth writing these down. And you can change them, you can move with them. I mean, and every principle you hold should benefit you. That's a very, you don't say, I'm going to give everyone respect, not because Jesus told me to, but because it behooves me and I benefit from this. And if you can, you set down those principles, and again, just like we talked about earlier for the corporation, it makes your decisions thereafter flow that much more easily.
Yeah. Now that's a very clever and insightful way to rephrase Adam Smith, who said, if we pursue our own self-interest, we build something beautiful for society.
Yes, we do. And it is, business is filled with contributors. Mm-hmm. And frankly, does it bother me at all that Bill Gates has a foundation in which a large part of it is giving computers to people who will end up using his software? That doesn't bother me slightly. Mm-hmm. What is marvelous is that they get given there. And first of all, every reason you have for doing everything is a cocktail of reasons. It's not just one. And if you don't serve yourself, as I said, you will either abandon the venture, or you'll do it under with a grudgingness that is horrendous.
Right. You mentioned strengths and interests, Bart, and write those down. And I love that advice. There's another word you mentioned in your book, and I'm not sure whether I got it entirely right. And it's proclivities.
Proclivities
are vital, you say.
Yes, they are. I think it's probably one of my biggest blunders. It was the word that was absolutely, it's one of those things that absolutely perfectly described what I was looking for and didn't communicate it. By proclivities, I mean your leanings, your tendencies, the way you approach things. The way you most prefer to operate. For instance, I have a proclivity toward physical action. It's my way. I have a proclivity towards talking out solutions. It's just here on the show, as you answer me questions, someone says I talk and talk and talk until I have something to say, and I will talk through a solution. Now, my COO is one of her proclivity is to study, to delve, to go through all the details, the learning, the authority. And that's her proclivity. So the idea is that I have this interest in discussion. I have this proclivity towards talking things out. Mm-hmm. That gives me an interest toward discussion, and it gives me the strength of ending up being a good speaker, hopefully. And my COO, for instance, will get the strength and of being able to grab me by the collar and filling me in with the vital details that I've, of course, gloriously overlooked.
So proclivities, they require some self-analysis, it sounds like.
Oh, yes, unlike profanity, which is a very poor way of giving a really good insult.
So there's an interesting summation in this book, The CEO of Yourself. I'm going to give you the end of it and then the beginning of it. You said, I finally realized this is the whole point. And that comes at the end of a phrase that says, CEOs' techniques are more reflective of their individual characters than of any standard business practice. And it's the individuality that's the whole point. And another word that you use, your marvelous own self is the enterprise of which you will take charge. So let's leave people with that, Bart. Tell us about the marvelous own self and that individuality is the whole point.
Okay, I think that is, thank you, and because it really is, that's the message I think that unfortunately gets lost. We have a million beggars at our door persuading us that we need makeovers in a million ways, you know, put this faith in your heart and put this deodorant under your arms and so forth. The truth is, you really are, you yourself are a marvelous person. And if you don't see that, maybe you're searching in the wrong rooms of your house or using other people's yardsticks, or maybe you're standing in the shadow of somebody else who's real or imagined. But if you walk around and find all those assets that you have, all the things that you're able to do, you will find that marvelous self. And that will lead toward being the person that you want to be. I kick off my radio show, my own The Art of CEO radio show, or I don't kick it off. Somewhere in the middle of it, I always say, the good Lord has gifted you with the title and privileges of chief executive officer of yourself. And since that's really the most important position you'll ever hold in your career, allow me to ask, is this the day you'll dust off your dreams or something? Mm-hmm. But the deal is this is what you've got to deal with. And it's wonderful. And the more you look into yourself, the more wonders you're going to find. It's like a scientist who goes down and looks into a tree, and the more he finds, the more wonderful it all is. And this is you. And that strength, that will be that true, honest self of yours, that will inspire anybody. It doesn't matter. It's not types of leadership. It's you, yourself leading you. And after that comes everything else.
Well, Bud, thank you. You've given us a great gift of analyzing the job of CEO, analyzing the individual as CEO, and now this confidence that we each are marvelous, and that's what we should be CEO of, our marvelous self. So thank you very, very much for all of your guidance and insight.
You have done a great deal of pulling out the very best that I and all the people I've been talking to have to offer. And so I hope that you will continue.
Bud, thank you very much.
Thank you. Take good care.
Economics for Business is a production of the Mises Institute. To explore more content like this, visit Mises.org. And for more from Hunter Hastings, visit HunterHastings.com.